The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Patricia Stevenson is with me in studio, the Social Democrat Senator, to talk about the trip she was recently on to the West Bank. And Patricia, you're welcome to studio.
Thanks
a million for coming in to us. There's understandably been this huge focus on Gaza and what's happening there. And I don't think people are ignorant of the West Bank, but it doesn't get the same level of attention, understandably. So that's why I'm interested in talking to you. So maybe before, explain when you were there and who you were there with and where you went.
Yeah, so I went out in early September and I met various different organisations, human rights organisations. One of them was Al-Haq, who've recently been sanctioned by the US administration for their contribution to the ICC case. I met with Badil, a refugee rights organisation in Ada refugee camp, and also the Laji Centre, who many of your listeners might be familiar with, because there was a Laji cultural tour that was supposed to come to Ireland in July, but the visas weren't. So I met with different groups like that. And yeah, you know, like, it is understandable that Gaza does take the majority of, you know, of our focus. But I think at the same time, what's happening in the West Bank is, like, it has been a huge escalation since what's happened in Gaza, since October 2023. And I think the Israeli regime is taking advantage of that, of you know, the kind of the international eye being elsewhere.
Okay.
And certainly settler violence has increased, you know, exponentially. And it's I believe they're using this kind of cloak of Gaza to kind of move in a lot more and really destroy Palestinian lives there.
Yeah, we'll talk about all the politics of that in just a moment, but maybe paint a picture for us about life in the West Bank. Or maybe it's instructive to for you actually to paint a picture of what we're talking about when we talk about the West Bank. I mean, how different maybe is life in different parts of the West Bank?
Absolutely. So the West Bank is kind of broken into three zones from the Oslo Accords. It's a little bit arbitrary, but that was decided in the 90s. You've got your Area A, your Area B, your Area C. Some parts of the West Bank are like Ramallah, the capital, would have be a thriving Palestinian city. And you'll have other areas like Hebron, a really large city as well, but it's actually been divided. So half of Hebron is called H2, and that's actually the Israeli side of it. They moved in and pushed all the Palestinians out. And so you have this kind of, you have a lot of division even within cities and towns. And then you have loads of kind of farming land, agricultural land, date farms, olive trees. Olives are a really important livelihood for Palestinian families. So you could be kind of, I drove down to the South Jordan Valley near the Dead Sea, where you can see, like, you know, loads of agricultural land. And oddly enough, you can see green, luscious farms. Those farms are owned by the Israelis because they are sequestering all the water towards their land. And then you'll see kind of, you know, sort of struggling olive trees that belong to the Palestinians. And so really, when you're driving in the roads in the West Bank, some roads only Israelis are allowed on. Big walls. They're called there's one famous one called the Apartheid Road. Roads are being used as a way to divide communities. So like North West Bank from South West Bank, roads are being built that only Israelis can use, so that Palestinians would have to travel all the way around in a big circle to meet their family, to meet their friends, potentially to work. It's all a tool of the occupation to make life harder for them.
And the rationale is presented as what? As one of security?
Security. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a very easy rationale to say. I mean, I'm from Belfast originally, and, you know, walls were put up in the name of security there as well.
Peace walls.
I know, ostensibly. You know, I think it's really important to remind people as well that Hamas don't exist in the West Bank. And so when we have this call for security, it doesn't, you know, the evidence isn't there. Security from water.
And how is that enforced? How do they enforce only? Is that there's obviously army checkpoints.
Army
then.
Military checkpoints. It's a highly militarized society, like IDF, but also security and police that are all, you know, they're not like our community police. They all have weapons, and settlers actually also are allowed to carry weapons. So you'll just see a civilian settler who will have a gun strapped around them as well. So lots of checkpoints. People can't get from, you know, something that should be a 10-minute journey could be a 2-hour journey because you're sitting in this monstrous queue, or you've got to drive all the way around to a quieter checkpoint. Again, it's like designed to make life impossible. Palestinians who live in the West Bank have a different ID to Palestinians that live in Jerusalem. And so they can't get into Jerusalem as easily. And in fact, work permits and all travel permits were blocked by the Israeli regime since October 2023.
So to what extent could you describe those parts of the West Bank that fall under Palestinian authority as having a functioning economy or a functioning civil society?
I mean, it has had a functioning economy and civil society, but the Israeli regime is doing everything it can to close that down. So I gave the example of the human rights organization Al-Haq that was sanctioned by the US. The sanctioning of the US basically means no one can trade with them. The Palestinian bank will no longer host their bank accounts, which means they can't pay staff. So it's these little measures which kind of make it increasingly impossible for anyone to function. The Palestinian Authority, they haven't been able to pay their teachers this year, so teachers are actually striking. Taxes that the Palestinian Authority that might be raised in the West Bank, Israel is increasingly taking that tax and using it to fund the settler communities instead of the Palestinian communities. So, you know, this is kind of just incredible, the idea that people can pay their taxes. The Palestinian Authority aren't receiving that money, and it's going to the settler community who are oppressing the Palestinian people.
And the settler community, again, the vision that we're used to seeing is often that agricultural vista, as you mentioned, maybe this kind of scorched and arid landscape, Palestinian farmers kind of eking out a living on it, and these Israeli settlers going in and kind of confronting them. They're armed, they kick them off their own land, and they claim it for themselves. How much of that, I mean, that's obviously happening. Does that only tell part of the story? There's obviously, about H2 and Hebron being split in two. There's obviously a kind of a program of settlement that happens in an urban environment too, is there?
And there's enormous urban settlements. There's a place called Ma'al Adamim. It's a part of the big E1 plan that some people listening might have heard of a few months ago. And it is like glorious, you know, big palm tree lined avenues, this enormous shopping center selling like Versace like furniture, really high-end stuff. And it's quite eerie because it's really sanitized, and it's kind of attracting people that might not have an extremist ideology to themselves, who might not want to live in the outposts that you're describing, the kind of harder living. The people that are living in those places that you're describing, they're really driven by this extremist ideology. But in these more sanitized kind of suburbia, lots of people will move there, and they might not even know that they're actually on occupied land. And that's the goal. And this E1 plan that people might have heard of, that the Israeli state say they're moving ahead with, it's really critical. It used to be a red line for the US administration back in the Clinton days, and they are moving ahead with it. And it's basically going to make a big suburbia between Jerusalem and this existing settlement called Ma'al Adamim on all the stolen land, which is currently kind of farmland, unused farmland. They're going to make a complete, they're building roads, they're going to build thousands of apartments, and people will move in there without even realizing whose land that is.
And when you're speaking then to ordinary Palestinians living in the West Bank, in the cities or out in the countryside, or different people from those groups that you mentioned, what's their sense of the direction of travel? I mean, if you were to ask them, you know, what do Benjamin Netanyahu and his government have in mind for the West Bank?
The extermination of the Palestinian people. And this isn't something that Benjamin Netanyahu has had alone, or even Smotrich or Ben-Gavir.
Can I ask, when you say the extermination of the Palestinian people, do you mean like in terms of their national identity, that, you know, that it's all becomes part of a greater Israel, but those Palestinians just exist in it, or that they don't exist in it? They actually move to Egypt or Jordan or somewhere else.
I think their preference would be that they leave the land altogether. I don't think that they want to share the land at all. And I think it's just really important that this isn't just like a bad apple. It's not just Netanyahu and a few advisors. This has been built into the Israeli regime for decades. All of these plans that are taking place, it is like the outcome of years, decades worth of policy coming to fruition. And yeah, I think they would rather they weren't there. And the Palestinian people, they know that, but they continue to show like a huge amount of resiliency to that. I met all of these young people in Ada Refugee Camp, which is in Bethlehem. Ada Refugee Camp's been around since 1950. So it's like, it's a city in of itself. Some people might see refugee camps on the telly from other contexts, but it's not like that. It's like a proper city. And all these young people, they'll say their name and they'll say where they're from, but it's not where they're from. It's where their parents are from, or where their grandparents are from, and where they fled in 1948 Nakba or the Six-Day War in 1967. And so people have a real sense of collective consciousness about like where they're actually from, and a desire to eventually, hopefully in their eyes, one day move back there. And that's, you know, that was a sense of hope for me, despite the rest of the trip being quite bleak.
So, if the view of Benjamin Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and other people, it's not just them, as you say, there's you know, a broader cohort of people who'd be supportive of this. Not everybody in Israel, far from it, but there is kind of broad support. If their view is that a greater Israel can't be achieved with all these Palestinians living in it, we need control of that land. What about the opposite? Can a two-state solution exist? Is it viable with all those Israelis now on that land? Or do they have to now be, does Hebron, do all those Israeli settlers have moved into Hebron, do they have to be removed? Does that settlement that's selling Versace, does that have to be dismantled or handed over to the Palestinians? All of those farmers who are kind of irrigating their lands with what was Palestinian water, do they have to be moved?
I think it's a good question. It's not a question for me to answer or for us to answer.
Let me put it this way then. What's the view of the people you spoke to about that, about their presence now and about how permanent they see that their presence?
I don't think people can even think that far. I think the extent of the settler violence and the incursions and the daily attacks and you know, the IDF knocking on people's doors in the middle of the night, I think all of that stuff is the kind of now and the present that people aren't necessarily even thinking that long. I think ultimately, like, the Palestinian people I met, they want the right to return. They really believe in the right to return to their land and their communities. And, you know, how they do that and in what format would be a conversation for the future.
What do those people then, and those civil society groups as well that you met with, what's their view about the support, the level of support or otherwise that they get from other countries around the world?
You know,
they've often talked about kind of being this forgotten people, you know what I mean, that... and I know I've spoken to them, to Palestinians from Gaza and from the West Bank on this show, and... You know, they say one of the complaints that they might make is that you were getting all this attention now, but, you know, where was it for all those kind of years, kind of post-intifada and pre-October 7th, when we were saying, listen, why is nobody kind of coming to our aid?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is people I met were very, very, very conscious and very aware of the support of the Irish people, and that consistently said that. And some people I met said, like, this is your home too. You know, we recognise what the Irish people have done for us. And, you know, we consider this your home. So there is that recognition and that like understanding of like that sort of transnational solidarity. I think there is a real sense of like, you know, when will the international community act? Like, how bad does something have to get? And why are the systems so broken that we have, that people can't act in a faster way? You know, just a real sense of despair about, like, we've all bought into the concept of international law, most of us, right?
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, you believe in that concept. I said this the other day, like, you believe in money because we believe in money, like the piece of paper that is money. International law is the same thing.
Yeah, its only value is people believing in it. If
and
people stop believing
it.
In it, it disappears.
Yeah, and so I think that a lot of the people I met had that kind of like, if not now, when? And, you know, I think that's a question a lot of us across Ireland, across the world can ask.
Yeah. Well, listen, Patricia, thanks a million for coming into us and talking about all of it. Patricia Stevenson, Social Democrat Senator.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.